And what the hell is it about? Stevenhurst. Instinctively, my jaw clenches. What has he got to do with any of it? He's been obstructing the progress of the country park scheme for months, stopping developers getting access to the land. I thought he wanted to build houses. That's what he wants people to think. I think he's protecting what's beneath the ground. Why? Marie is very ill. Cancer. I know. Terminal cancer. She has months, maybe weeks left. She is dying. I remember the wave of dread I felt in the pub. Marie is not going to die. I will not let that happen. No. I shake my head. Not even Hurst is that insane. But he is desperate. And desperate people will try anything. They're looking for a miracle. She leans forward and rests a cool, dry hand on mine. Of course, that is seldom what they find. Do you understand now why I wanted you to come back? I do. And the understanding carves a deep, cold chasm out of my insides. He wants to save her, I say. And I think you are the only person who can stop him. 30. I sit on the sofa, a glass of bourbon and the pack of playing cards on the coffee table in front of me. I haven't touched either yet. The fire isn't lit and the room is in darkness. I still have my coat on. It's cold, but then it always is. In the faint moonlight shining through from the kitchen window, I can see Abby Eyes on the opposite armchair, regarding me with her new and even more nightmarish gaze. She is not my only company. I can sense them, close by. Not just the skittering, chittering sounds I have become almost accustomed to. Other companions. Silent, but watching. I open the pack of cards, for the first time in a long time, and start to shuffle them. It's not my problem, okay? I spit the words out into the darkness and wait for it to challenge me. It doesn't reply, but I feel eyes upon me, full of blackness. I tried to stop it before, it didn't work. The darkness bristles. The chittering increases, like I have said something that annoys it. I deal the cards out, four hands for my invisible players. Then I reach for my drink and throw it back. Dutch courage. Stupid phrase. False courage. No matter what the tongue. I don't owe Hurst anything. So let him go ahead. Let him learn. I don't care. Except, the darkness chides, like a parent to a tantrum-throwing child. That's not true, is it, Joe? Because this isn't just about Hurst. It's about Marie, a girl you once had feelings for, a woman who is dying, who deserves to do that in some sort of peace. Because there are things worse than death. Because what comes back isn't always what left. And you're the only person who can stop it. I try to stare the darkness down. But the darkness doesn't budge, doesn't blink. If anything, it seems to draw closer, pressing itself against me like an unwelcome lover. And now I can see something else lurking in its folds. Figures, shadows within shadows. Because the dead never really leave us. We carry them inside, in everything we do. In our dreams and nightmares. The dead are a part of us, And maybe they're a part of something else, too. This place. This earth. But what if the earth is rotten? What if the things you plant there grow back full of poison? I think about how you can never build the same snowman, or how the tapes that Dad's mate copied were always fuzzy and corrupted. There are some things, some beautiful, perfect things, you can never recreate without ruining them. I hear movement. The creak of a door. The soft tread of footsteps. I'm ready. What do you want from me? I ask. What do you want me to do?
Well, for a start, you could turn the feckin' lights on.
I jump and spin around, just as the living room floods with light.
Jesus.
I shield my eyes like a vampire exposed to the burning rays of the dawn. I squint through my fingers. Brendan stands near the doorway, resplendent in army jacket, baggy jumper, cords and tattered green flash trainers. A large holdall is slung over his shoulder. He regards me from within his nest of tangled hair and beard.
What the fuck are you doing here, sitting in the dark, talking to yourself?
I just stare at him. Then I shake my head. Am I the only person who knocks on a door anymore? Brendan makes terrible coffee. It is also past midnight, not my preferred coffee drinking hour. But I am too tired, confused and wrung out to argue the case against it. He emerges from the kitchen with two mugs, plonks one down in front of me, and looks around for somewhere to sit with his. I love what you've done with the place. It's called Deconstructed.
It's called something.
I nod towards the armchair. Sit. Abby Eyes loves company. He eyes the doll.
This is probably stating the obvious, but sitting here talking to a one-eyed doll is even more bloody creepy than talking to yourself.
He removes Abby Eyes and places her on the floor with a shudder, then sits and clasps his mug. The holdall rests at his feet. I look down at it.
I was expecting a courier, not personal delivery.
Yeah, well, I figured the petrol was cheaper.
You haven't got a car.
I borrowed my sister's.
What about work?
I can give it a miss for a couple of days. And I'm glad I did, because you look like shite, my man. Countryside air does not agree with you.
I rub at my eyes.
Well, I won't be breathing it much longer. One way or another.
Your plan is coming to fruition?
Something like that.
Is that why you've got a pack of playing cards out?
I glance at the hands of cards I have dealt on the table.
That was just killing time.
You're not planning on winning your money back?
No. Of course not.
Thank fuck for that. Don't take this wrong, but you're a shite card player.
And you couldn't have told me that before someone made matchsticks out of my leg?
You got to want to hear it.
He looks down at the holdall.
So, presumably, and I don't think I'll be stepping on Sherlock's toes when I deduce this, it has something to do with what's in this bag.
Bravo, dear Watson.
So?
I raise an eyebrow, or at least I try.
The effort is a little too much tonight. Someone is going to pay me a lot of money not to take that to the police.
I lean forward and lift the holdall onto the coffee table.
Have you looked inside?
I figured if you wanted me to know, you'd show me.
I unzip the top and carefully take out a bulky shape wrapped in an old sweatshirt. I unfold the sweatshirt, revealing two items carefully preserved inside a clear plastic bag. A crowbar and a dark blue school tie, darker in places where it soaked up the blood. My sister's blood. Just visible. A name sewn into it. S. Hurst.
What the fuck is this?
Brendan asks. Payback. 31. 1992. Falling doesn't kill you. Stopping kills you. That's what Chris told me. People think that when you fall from a great height, your brain shuts down before you hit the ground. Not true. It's possible, because of the speed at which your brain processes information, that it may not have time to consciously comprehend the actual impact. But that doesn't mean it isn't furiously working all the way down, right until the final crunch. I had English in the block last period, the day that Chris fell. We read from Animal Farm. I never liked that novel. I was not then or now a fan of overly heavy-handed symbolism. In my 15-year-old opinion, you could just as easily have told the story with people instead of dressing it up with animals. I didn't see the point. I didn't like the conceit. It was like the author thought he was being clever, and no one could see through his book pretending to be one thing when it wasn't. But you could. And it wasn't clever. It was like a magic act, where you could still see the trick, but the magician still thought they were all that. Orwell wasn't all that. But 1984 was good. It didn't pretend. It was just harsh and scary and brutal. To be fair, I wasn't thinking much about the book during this particular lesson. I was distracted. I'd been distracted a lot over the previous few weeks. Annie had been back for almost a month. The initial euphoria and attention had faded, but it still should have been a happy time. Things should have been getting back to normal, but they weren't. I wasn't even sure I knew what normal was anymore. For the first few days, I tried to talk to Annie, to coax out of her what had happened that night. But she just stared at me, with eyes that were muddy with incomprehension. Occasionally, she smiled or giggled for no reason. The sound of her laughter, which had always made me feel warm inside, now set my teeth on edge like nails down a blackboard. Mom still wasn't around much because she was spending most of her time caring for Nan, who wasn't doing so well after the fall. Dad had taken leave from work to help look after Annie until she was ready to go back to school. Or so he said. It wasn't true. I had seen a letter sticking out of his jacket pocket one evening. At the top it read, P45. I knew what that meant. That he had left his job, or been sacked. I tucked the letter further into his pocket and didn't say a word to Mum. There were a lot of things I wasn't telling Mum. Couldn't tell her. Because I didn't want to worry her. Because I didn't want to make her unhappy. Because I was scared she wouldn't believe me. I didn't tell her that I had started to dread going home after school because Dad would already be drunk and the house would stink. Not just of booze, of something worse, something fetid and sour. The sort of smell you might get when something has crawled under the floorboards to die. Mum even sent Dad and me looking for a dead mouse one night. When we couldn't find anything, she rolled her eyes and said, "I'm sure it will pass." I didn't tell her she was wrong, that the smell wasn't a dead mouse. It was something else that had come to nest in our home. I didn't tell her that I lay awake most nights listening to the noises from Annie's room next door. Sometimes it would be the same song, over and over. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. Other nights, there would be terrible shouts and screams. I would put my Walkman headphones on, or jam my pillow over my head. Anything to muffle the sounds. In the morning I would go into Annie's room, pull the urine-soaked sheets off her bed and stuff them in the washing machine, sticking it on before I went to school. Mum probably thought I was trying to help Dad. And to be fair, If I hadn't done the washing, it wouldn't have got done. But that wasn't the real reason. I did it because I felt responsible. This was my lot. Penitence. Punishment for what I had done. Or for what I hadn't done. I hadn't saved her. I didn't tell anyone that sometimes I changed my own sheets too. That I twitched at every creak in the house, because I might turn and find Annie standing there, clutching at the eyes. Not speaking, just smiling and staring at me with those eyes that were too dark and old for an 8-year-old. I didn't want to admit, even to myself, that sometimes I was scared to death of my own little sister. The bell rang for the end of lesson. I stuffed my books into my bag and scraped my chair back. The seat next to me was empty. Chris used to sit there, but now he had taken to sitting on his own, at a spare desk near the back. I was relieved. Not just because I didn't want to speak to him, didn't want to hear him make excuses or give apologies for what they did that night, but also because something was going on with Chris, and it wasn't good. His appearance was more unkempt than ever. His stutter was worse. He had taken to humming and murmuring to himself. Sometimes he would suddenly stop and brush manically at his arms, like he was brushing off invisible dirt. Or insects. Normally he scuttled out of class first. That way he could avoid the name-calling, the deliberate tripping and shoving. Now he wasn't hanging around with Hurst anymore. Neither of us was. He was devoid of his invisible shield. I didn't stick up for him. I had my own problems, my own worries. So, when I saw that this afternoon he had lingered behind when he fell into a shambling step beside me as I hurried down the stairs, I was pissed off. What is it?
I need to show you something.
His breath smelled stale, like he hadn't brushed his teeth. His shirt stank of B.O. What?
Can't tell you here.
Why?
Too many people.
We reached the ground floor. I pushed open the door to the courtyard outside. Other pupils thronged around us, the usual hustle and bustle of home time. Chris's face was flushed. I could see him trying to force the words out. I felt bad for him, despite myself.
Just try and breathe, okay?
He nodded and took several deep breaths. I waited.
The graveyard. Meet me there. 6 p.m. Important.
I wanted to come up with an excuse, but what was the alternative? Make sure Dad hadn't set the house on fire after falling asleep with a cigarette. Check my sister was still there, still not being Annie.
Okay,
I sighed. It better be good. Chris nodded, put his head down like he was running for cover, and scurried around the corner. I adjusted my bag on my shoulder and heard laughter behind me. I glanced around. Hurst had emerged from the English block doors, Fletch following him like a greasy shadow. Hurst looked over, smirked, then whispered something to him. I saw them both chortle. I clenched my fists, dug my nails into my palms, and forced myself to turn away.
I'd just get into more trouble.
Mum would be upset, Dad would belt me. Hurst would win. Again. What was the point? I put my head down and marched resolutely towards the gates. I didn't head straight back home. I never did now. I walked the streets, ate chips in the bus shelter, hung out in the playground if Hurst and Fletch weren't there. Anything to delay the moment I would have to push open the door and be confronted by the smell, the cloying darkness, the creeping cold that would wrap itself around me. I only had a few pence in my pocket today. I couldn't go to the chippy or the sweet shop, so I dawdled along the high street, kicking at an empty pop bottle. I wandered past the small patch of grass where the brass statue of a miner stood. There was a bench beside it. Usually it was empty. Today, a solitary figure sat there, hunched over in an oversized army jacket, head down, dark hair falling over her face. Marie. We hadn't spoken since the night down the pit. To be honest, I wasn't sure she remembered a lot of it. I'd like to say this made me think less of her, that she had slipped from the pedestal I'd put her upon. But that wasn't true. The sight of her still tugged at my heart, and other places. I hovered awkwardly. Are you okay? She looked up through her hair.
Joe?
She sniffed and rubbed at her nose. I realized she was crying. I hesitated, and then I slung my bag off my shoulders and sat down next to her.
What's wrong?
She shook her head, voice clogged by tears and snot.
I've been an idiot.
Why?
I'm sorry. About what happened with your sister.
It's okay, I said, even though it wasn't.
It was so crazy down there. I mean, I can't believe we thought she was, you know.
I swallowed a hard lump in my throat.
I know.
She shook her head again.
You don't know how much I wanted to talk to you, but I was scared.
Scared?
Of what?
She pulled her hair across her face self-consciously.
Nothing.
But it didn't seem like nothing. The tremor in her voice, the way she was shielding her face with her hair, I suddenly had a feeling.
Is something the matter with your eye?
No, it's... I leaned forward and brushed her hair behind her ear. She didn't stop me. Her right eye was blue-black and swollen.
What happened?
We argued. He didn't mean it.
Anger swelled into a hot ball in my throat. Hurst did this. Hurst was a bastard, but I'd never known him to use his fists on a girl.
Just leave it.
He hit you. You have to tell someone.
Please, Joe, you mustn't say anything.
She grabbed my hands.
Promise.
I didn't have much choice.
Okay. But promise me you won't let it happen again.
Okay.
Why were you arguing?
It was about Chris.
Chris?
Steve is scared he's going to say something about the pit. He's acting so weird. Steve said he's got something he shouldn't, and he needs to be sorted. I told him to leave Chris alone, and then I said I wanted to split up, and that's when...
When he hit you?
He called me a bitch, and said no one leaves him, ever.
Fresh tears welled in her eyes. I wrapped my arms around her and drew her close. Her hair was scratchy. Smelled of hairspray and smoke.
Joe,
she whispered.
What do we do?
I'll sort it, I said. I'm meeting Chris at 6 in the graveyard. I can warn him. She pulled away a little.
Maybe you could talk to him. Tell him not to say anything. Stop with all the crazy shit.
I don't know.
You're good at talking to people.
Okay, I'll try.
Thank you.
She leaned forward and pressed her lips against mine. Then she hopped up.
I should go.
I nodded, numb with shock.
"Do you want to walk back with me?"
I asked.
"I can't. I have to get some shopping for my mum."
"Oh,
okay. I'll see you later."
"See you." I watched her go, the memory of her kiss tingling on my lips, thinking about what I'd like to do to Hurst. Perhaps that's why I never thought about what I had just said. Dad was semi-conscious in front of the TV when I got back. Annie must have been in her room. Mum had left some meals in the freezer. I got one out and stuck it in the microwave. I wasn't that hungry, but I forced myself to eat a bit of the lasagna, downed a Coke, and then shouted to Dad that there was food in the kitchen and headed upstairs to change. At the door to Annie's room, I paused. I used to like hovering at her door sometimes, watching her unawares as she engaged in some imaginary play with her Barbie dolls and my old action men, putting on different voices. Now, her door was always closed, and the voices inside were different. This evening I couldn't hear anything. The silence was worse. I hesitated. But it was tea time. Annie must be hungry. I couldn't rely upon Dad to feed her. I raised my hand and knocked on the door. "Annie?" No reply. "Annie?" The door opened a couple of inches. I pushed it further, trying not to recoil at the smell. Annie stood on the far side of the room, staring out of the window. She must have run over to the door, opened it, and run back. But I couldn't be sure of that. I couldn't be sure of anything anymore. I stepped into the bedroom. "I've just heated up some lasagna." She remained still. I suddenly realized that she had on an old sweatshirt, but no jeans or knickers. "Well, let me know if you want some." She turned. I flushed. Annie was still only a kid, but I hadn't seen her naked since she was a baby. As if sensing my awkwardness, she smiled. A sly, dreadful thing. She took a step forward, parted her feet, and a stream of hot yellow urine gushed from between her legs and onto the carpet. I felt bile rise in my throat. She started to laugh. I bolted from her room, slammed the door behind me, and ran down the stairs. I didn't care about changing. I just wanted to get away. Away from my little sister. Her laughter chased me out of the house. But now it sounded more like screams, snapping at my heels. Chris wasn't in the graveyard. I pushed open the gate and walked down the overgrown path. I wandered around the church in a circle, in case he was hiding somewhere, which would be weird but not unthinkable. No Chris. No sign of any living soul. I sighed. Typical. He was losing it. Seriously losing it. But then, I wasn't exactly coasting along on an even keel at the moment. I couldn't get the image of Annie out of my mind. Her nakedness. The urine streaming between her skinny legs. I couldn't go back. Not tonight. The thought of ever going back seemed beyond comprehension. Maybe she needed to see a doctor again. Maybe the blow to her head, and there had been a blow to her head, I was sure, had done something to her brain. I mean, she had lost her memory. She couldn't remember where she had been for those 48 hours. Maybe there was something else wrong, something that was making her act so weird. I should try and talk to Mum. She could take her to the hospital, maybe they could fix her. Make her better. Make her Annie again. The thought gave me some comfort, even though I'm not sure I really believed it. But then, maybe that's what churches are for. To give comfort even when, deep down, you know it's just a pack of lies. I sat on the rickety bench in the graveyard and stared out over the lopsided grey headstones. I leaned forward, resting my elbows on my knees, tucking my feet beneath me. That's when I realized that there was something under the bench. I bent over and hauled it out. A bag. I knew straight away it was Chris's. While the rest of us had Adidas or Puma, Chris had an old, unbranded holdall covered with Doctor Who and Star Trek stickers. This evening there was something else stuck on it. An envelope, taped to the top, with my name scrawled on the front. I ripped it off and opened it. Inside, a torn-off sheet of textbook paper was covered in Chris's straggly scrawl.
Joe, the stuff in this bag is for you. You'll know what to do. The other things, I think you might need them sometime. I'm not sure why. Just in case. This is all my fault. I wish I had never found it. That place is bad. I know that now. Maybe you do too. I'm sorry. About Annie. About everything.
I stared at the note, like the words would rearrange themselves into something that made sense. Something that didn't sound batshit crazy. Why had he left it for me? Why wasn't he here himself? I unzipped the holdall. The first thing I saw was a stack of fireworks, big fuck-off ones. The sort you needed ID to buy, unless you were good at finding a way to get stuff. I frowned and delved deeper. Underneath was something else, something heavier, wrapped carefully in a clear plastic bag. I took it out, and my stomach flipped. I knew what this was straight away. I stared at the two items inside. Then I carefully put the bag back and zipped the holdall up. Chris's house was the other side of the village. I slung the holdall over my shoulder and started to walk. I needed to talk to him. For some reason it felt urgent. I had this weird jittery feeling in my stomach, like I was already late for something important. I picked up my pace. Bits of the note kept fluttering around my mind.
That place is bad.
I walked past the bench where Marie had pressed her lips to mine. Something flared, like a dark shadow on the walls of my mind, and then it was gone again.
Maybe you could talk to him?
I found myself at the gates of the school. They were usually left open back then, until all the after-school clubs had finished and the teachers had gone. It was quicker to cut through the school grounds to Chris's house and slip out of the fence the other side, so long as the caretaker didn't catch me. I hurried across the car park, past the science wing and towards the block. It rose before me, a dark monolith against the silvery sky. As I rounded the corner, a gust of wind slapped me in the face and snatched at my hair. I shivered. And then I paused. I thought I'd heard something. Voices. Carrying on the wind.
From the playing fields?
No. Closer. I looked around, and then I looked up.
I saw him. Already falling.
I felt the whoosh as he cut through the air. Heard the dull thud as he hit the ground. The distance between an eternity and the blink of an eye. I wondered if he felt it. The final crunch. My first instinct was to run. To get the hell away. But I couldn't. I couldn't just leave him lying there. What if he was still alive? I walked over on shaking legs. His eyes were open, and a small trickle of blood ran down the side of his mouth. More blood spread out beneath him, forming a crimson halo around his blonde head. The weird thing was, for perhaps the first time ever in his short life, he looked calm, like he had finally found the thing he was always looking for. I let the bag slip from my shoulders and sank to the ground. I stayed there, kneeling beside him on the cold concrete, in the fading warmth of the day. Tears slipped down my cheeks. I gently stroked his soft, shaggy hair. I told him it wasn't his fault. Later, because it had always been too late for Chris, perhaps for some kids it always is, I got up, brushed the dirt from my trousers, and walked down the road to a phone box. I called an ambulance. I told them a kid had fallen. I didn't tell them who. I didn't tell them my name. And I didn't tell them, or anyone, what else I saw that evening. A second figure, running away from the block. No more than a dark shadow. But I knew, even then, he needs to be sorted. Stephen Hurst. 32. The next day, I make plans. This is out of character for me. I'm not someone who believes in planning ahead. I've seen firsthand how planning is a predictor of disaster, an invitation for fate to screw with you. But for this, I need to be prepared. I need to have a course of action, and without a job it's not like I have much else to do. Brendan left the cottage just before 2 this morning. I offered him the spare room, but he declined. No offence, but this place gives me the feckin' creeps. I thought you weren't superstitious. I'm Irish. Of course I'm superstitious. Along with guilt, it's in our DNA. He shrugged his coat on. I've booked into a B&B down the road. The farm, I think. Something momentarily flitting across my mind, then flitting out again, before I can grasp hold of it. It was important, I think. But like most important things in my life, now it's gone. I make a strong black coffee with the dregs of water in the kettle, and smoke 2 brisk cigarettes before getting down to work. I sit at the small kitchen table and start making notes. It doesn't take long. My plan is not complicated. I'm not quite sure why I felt the need to write it down at all, but then I'm a teacher. I find comfort and stability in the written word, pen and paper. Something tangible to cling on to. Or perhaps it's just procrastination. Unlike plans, I'm good at procrastination. Next, I pick up my phone and I make some calls. One goes to voicemail. I leave a message. The second is a little trickier. I'm not even sure if she will answer. My deadline has been and gone. Then I hear her voice. I explain what I need. I do not know whether she will say yes. I am not really in any position to be asking favours. Gloria sighs.
You realise this will take time? As well connected as I am, I'm not your fucking fairy godmother.
I fidget, fingering a cigarette. How long?
A couple of hours.
Thank you, I say. But the phone is already dead. I try not to take this as an omen. The third call is to an international number. This one took a bit of research. Maybe it isn't entirely necessary. But now the seed has been planted, I have to know. I put on my most professional voice. I explain who I am and what I would like to confirm. I listen as the very polite American receptionist tells me to get lost in a very polite American way. I accept her wishes for a nice day, although it seems unlikely, and end the call. I stare at the phone for a while, my heart just that little bit heavier. Then I get up to make another coffee. The final call I will make later. This isn't procrastination. I don't want to give him too much time to plan or to rally his goons. I'm waiting for the kettle to boil when my phone rings. I snatch it up. Hello?
I got your message.
And?
I've got lessons.
You've never played truant?
You want me to skive off school?
Not regularly, just this afternoon. It's important. A deep sigh.
Is this why they sacked you?
No. That was for something far worse. I wait.
Okay.
I sit on the scrubby grass, staring out over the coarse landscape. A place like this will never be pretty or picturesque, I think. It doesn't matter how many saplings you plant or wildflowers you seed, build all the playgrounds and visitor centres you like. Something about it will always remain barren and unyielding. A place like this does not want to be reclaimed. It is happy being forsaken, lying dormant and dead. A graveyard of lost livelihoods, lost dreams, coal dust and bones. We only skim the surface of this earth, but it has many layers, and sometimes you shouldn't dig too deep.
You're here.
A turn. Marcus stands behind me, on the incline of the small hill. Yep, and twice as ugly, I say. He doesn't smile. I get the feeling that humour, being happy, just isn't in his repertoire of emotions. But that's fine. Happiness is overrated. It's far too short-lived for a start. If you bought it on Amazon, you'd demand a refund. Broke after a month and impossible to fix. Next time we'll try misery. Apparently that shit lasts forever.
He walks over and stands awkwardly beside me. What are you doing?
Admiring the view and eating this. I hold up the wambar I have been chewing. And chewing. Want one? I brought two. He shakes his head.
No, thanks.
I regard the shiny pink candy. A friend of mine used to eat them. You remind me of him.
In what way?
He was a misfit. We both were. He liked finding out about stuff. And finding stuff. I think you might be good at that too, Marcus. Like how you found a way past the school security gates. He doesn't reply. You told Miss Grayson that Jeremy found the cave?
You did?
No. I shake my head. I don't think so. Some places have to want to be found. It takes someone special to do that. Not someone like Hurst. Someone like you. He debates and then says,
Hurst knew about the cave. A lot of the kids had heard rumours. He knew I came up here. He wanted me to help him look for a way in.
A nod. And you did.
I just kind of stumbled over it.
Yeah, that happens. He sits down beside me.
You want me to take you?
Not really. But I need you to take me.
You said it was important.
It is. He seems to notice the rucksack for the first time.
What's in there?
Probably best if you don't know. Silence for a moment. Then he stands.
Let's go.
I push myself to my feet. As I follow him down the hill, he says,
You know, you shouldn't offer sweets to strange kids.
Maybe he does have a sense of humour after all. There is no hatch this time. Instead, I find myself staring at a thick, semicircular grill beneath a low, rocky overhang. The metal is rusted almost the same colour as the earth, and camouflaged by overgrown weeds and thorns. Marcus pushes them aside and carefully removes the grill. It's heavy, and I can see gouge marks on the edges where it must have been forced open. At some point, the villagers tried to seal off all the entrances, I think, but they couldn't silence the pit. Couldn't stop it calling to Chris, to Marcus. I take out the torch I brought and point it into the hole. I can see that this tunnel is less steep than the one from my youth, but it's small, barely 2 feet high. I will have to crawl. This is not a comforting thought.
It's about 5 minutes till it opens up, and you reach some steps,
Marcus says.
They take you all the way down.
Thanks.
Are you going to stop people going down there?
That's the plan. You okay with that?
I suppose.
He stares at me.
You know, you're a weird sort of teacher.
I'm a weird sort of human. But weird isn't always bad. Remember that.
He gives a small nod. And I'm not sure, but it looks like a smile momentarily grazes his lips before he turns and lopes away.
The thin sun catches him on the brow of the hill. It illuminates his hair in a lighter halo. For a second, he looks like the ghost of a boy I once knew. Then he descends into shadow, and both ghost and boy are gone. My progress along the tunnel is slow and crab-like. My bad leg throbs constantly. Several times I stop and consider turning back. But turning itself is an issue, so I crouch and shuffle onwards, fighting the cloying claustrophobia rising in my throat, and wincing every time the rucksack on my back bumps against the tunnel roof. After what seems like several decades, during which my knees have been scraped raw and my spine has developed a permanent hunch, the tunnel widens enough for me to stand, albeit bent over. Steep steps lead down to what appears to be a solid rock wall. I run the torch over it. The light reveals a narrow gap, almost hidden in the depths of the shadows. Of course. Another way in. Or out. It explains how Annie disappeared, why I couldn't find her. I squeeze through. 25 years fall away. I'm standing in the cave from my childhood nightmares. It feels slightly smaller, shrunk by my adult perspective. The ceiling is not so high or cathedralesque, the space not so vast. This doesn't stop my scalp from bristling with ice. A few skulls lie on the ground, along with some crushed cans of woodpecker and cigarette butts. There are holes in the walls where Hurst and Fletch wreaked their wanton destruction, but higher up, the rock is still intricately inlaid with yellow and white bones. I stare at them. The ones who didn't come back. Left to be used as macabre decorations. Or perhaps some kind of offering. I wonder how long this place has been here. Hundreds, thousands of years. Amazing that the mining didn't destroy it. Or was it the other way around? I think about the Arnhill Colliery disaster. Despite all the investigations, never fully explained. No one ever held accountable. And what about the other accidents? There must be mine shafts beneath the cave. Did the miners get too close? Did they threaten the ancient excavation that came before them? A place that had been here for centuries, lying dormant, waiting. I walk slowly around, breathing deeply, trying to keep myself calm. This is just a cave. The dead cannot hurt us. Bones are just bones. Shadows are nothing but shadows. Except shadows are never just shadows. They are the deepest part of the darkness. And the deepest part of the darkness is where the monsters hide. I need to do this quickly. I take the item that Gloria brought me out of my rucksack. My hands are shaking. I am slick with sweat. I fumble, swear, catch myself. I have to do this right. Fuck this up, and I will take myself apart. I place it carefully, oh so carefully, in the center of the cave, my bandaged hand making me feel stupidly clumsy. Then I back away. I force myself to turn. I can hear them chittering now. A warning. A threat. I squeeze through the gap and hobble as fast as I can up the steps. I tell myself to be careful, that hurrying, careless steps are what they want. A trip, a fall, like before, would send me plunging back down. I reach the tunnel and crawl along it. At least my rucksack is now empty. The thought of what I carried down there, and a sudden paranoia that I have no guarantee it will work as planned, spurs me on and out. I emerge a sodden, shaking, jelly-legged mess into the fresh air, and collapse onto the stony ground. I lay there, gasping, letting the breeze cool the sweat on my skin. After a while, I sit back and fumble my cigarettes out of my pocket. I light one and suck it down like it's pure oxygen. I consider lighting a second off the butt of the first. Then I check my watch and reluctantly slide the cigarette back into the packet. Instead, I take out my mobile. Getting hold of his number wasn't difficult. I press call and wait. He answers on the third ring. Nearly always the third ring. Ever notice that? Hello? It's me. Silence. And then, feeling very much like a character in a bad thriller, I say, I think we should talk. 33. He's done well for himself. That's what we say, isn't it? When we see an expression of someone's wealth or success. Usually a big house, expensive suit, or shiny new car. Aren't how we measure things? As if the ability to purchase a large building or the most fuel-guzzling mode of sitting in a traffic jam is the ultimate expression of achievement during our scant years upon this planet. Despite all our advancements, we still judge people in terms of bricks, cloth, and horsepower. Still, I suppose on those terms Stephen Hirst has indeed done well for himself. His bricks and mortar is a converted farmhouse about half a mile outside of Arnhill, the sort of conversion that takes the original character of an old building and systematically tramples on it with the addition of acres of steel, glass, and bifold bloody doors. This evening, only one car sits on the gravel driveway, a brand new Range Rover. Marie is out with Jeremy in Nottingham, shopping for new trainers and then pizza. Around the back, I can see a long garden, a hot tub, and a floodlit swimming pool. A man does not own a hot tub and a swimming pool on a councillor's wages alone. Maybe that's why Marie stayed. And yet, ultimately, it all means nothing. Because the years of enjoying the hot tub and the swimming pool are fewer than she could ever have imagined. And maybe it would have been better to use the time to enjoy some freedom, a life away from this place. I guess it all depends on how much you want those bifold doors, and how much you are willing to sacrifice for them. I check my watch. 8:27 p.m. I hesitate a moment longer, then force myself to raise my arm and ring the doorbell. Distantly inside I hear chimes. I wait. Footsteps. And then the door swings open. I'd say it was impossible for a man to age in a couple of days, but I'd also swear this is exactly what has happened. In the harsh glare of the security light, Hurst looks like a much older man, pensionable even. His skin hangs from his face like a wet rag, and his eyes are bloodshot slits within folds of grey skin. He does not hold out a hand or offer a greeting. "My study's this way," he says, and turns, leaving me to close the door behind myself. The house isn't quite as I expected. It's more tasteful, if a little chintzy. I get the feeling that the satin wallpaper and faux Persian vases are evidence of Marie's hand. He leads me along the hallway. Ahead, I catch a glimpse of a large open-plan living room / diner. To my right, a sleek marble and chrome kitchen. Hurst opens another door on his left, his study. I feel an underlying current of resentment course through me. Hurst has all of this, with everything he has done. And a wife who's dying of cancer. I follow him into the room. In comparison to the rest of the house, the study is more minimalist. A large oak desk dominates. A few black and white pictures adorn the walls. A glass cabinet displays an array of crystal glasses and expensive whiskies. It's like a parody of a gentleman's study, even down to a heavy glass paperweight on the desk. The study of a man who believes he has done very well for himself indeed. Except, he doesn't look it right now. He looks like a man who is falling apart at his expensive custom-tailored seams. "Drink." He walks to the cabinet and half turns. "Whiskey?" "Fine by me." He pours two large measures into two sparkling crystal glasses and places them on the desk. "Sit." He gestures to an armchair in front of the desk. I place the bag on the floor next to the chair. I wait for Hurst to sit in his high-backed executive recliner, then lower myself onto the creaky leather. It puts me lower than him. Whatever makes him feel superior. I have the winning hand. For a moment nothing is said, nothing is drunk. Then, at the same time, we both reach for our glasses. "What do you want?" "I think you know." "You've come to beg me for your job back?" "You'd like that, wouldn't you?" "Not really. What I'd like is for you to go home. Leave us all in peace." "Some people don't deserve peace." "You've always thought the worst of me." "You always did the worst." "I was a kid. We all were. It was a long time ago." "How's Marie?" I ask. I can tell the question rattles him. "I don't want to talk about Marie. You're the one who sent her to see me." "Actually, it was her idea." "Not what she told me. But this is Hurst. Lies are as natural as breathing." "She thought she might be able to talk some sense into you. Avoid any more unpleasantness. Like sending Fletcher's boys to beat me up, trashing the cottage, that sort of unpleasantness." A thin, whip-sharp smile. "I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about." "Didn't find it, did they? I bet that really pissed you off." He shakes his head and takes a sip of his drink. "You seem to think I care more about the things that happened back then than I actually do." "You cared enough to follow Chris up the block that evening." "What happened? Did you argue? Did you push him?" He shakes his head like he's dealing with a sad lunatic.